2011-03, Felipa MacArthur versus Halloyne and OB versus Halloyne. And the way I've got the schedule set up, 25 minutes for Attorney Hildebrand, 15 minutes for Attorney McCracken, 15 minutes for Attorney Gutclass, at 5 minutes rebuttal for Attorney Hildebrand. Is that correct? Okay. Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you, Your Honor. I always appreciate the privilege of appearing before this distinguished court. This case involves very important issues involving the interplay of fundamental values as to the workings of our adversary system of justice. In order to work properly, that system involves parties who have the right to engage counsel in whom they have the utmost trust and confidence to represent them before the court. This is very important because clients must have the perception that they, as well as their attorneys, will be treated fairly and with courtesy and respect. And this is something all of us have known in our professional life. On the other hand, equally important is the fact that the courts before whom counsel appear must be able to control proceedings so that controversies may be resolved fairly and effectively. So sometimes the interplay of these two very important values can produce a case such as this, where there is a problem. And it's up to this court, really, to decide how to balance these two important factors. Because if the system works, then the courts will not only be able to render fair and appropriate decisions, but these decisions will be such so that they can be accepted as being fair and appropriate by the parties as well as the public. And that is why this case is so important. Because in Wisconsin, we have no case law at all governing the revocation of pro hoc vice attorneys. And one of the problems I think that all counsels have had in the briefing and the consideration of this case is that we don't have any precedent, and we do have the rule. But I think that one very important principle must be kept in mind. Once a court appoints or allows a pro hoc vice counsel to appear, that counsel must be able to appear on an equal footing with local Wisconsin counsel. Otherwise, the scales of justice will be tipped. If one counsel has to, in effect, have his hand, one hand tied behind his back and is restricted as to what he can do as far as zealous advocacy is concerned, unduly restricted, I might add, then the party who has chosen out-of-state counsel admitted pro hoc vice will not be there on an equal playing field, will not be there on an equal footing with local counsel, and the appearance of justice miscarried may be present in such an instance.
Mr. Hildebrand, what is the inequality that you're referring to?
The inequality here is, I think this whole situation arose because the trial judge in the Filippula case was very angry with Mr. Ball because he was persistent in his advocacy. And maybe he crossed the line and maybe he was too persistent, but this would have never happened to an in-state lawyer.
Well, what would the judge have done to an in-state lawyer?
Well, in this case, the judge decided that there would be a mistrial. The judge would have imposed the sanction here, $15,000, against the in-state lawyer, but the judge could not have disbarred the in-state lawyer. Now
we have pro hoc vice is for one case.
True.
So once you get a mistrial, isn't that case over?
No, the case is not over. It has to be tried again. And in this case, Mr. Ball had done all of the deposition work and had done all of the trial preparation work. This was a big case. So to declare a mistrial and then fire counsel means that some other lawyer has to do that work over. And not only that, as an experienced trial lawyer, any experienced trial lawyer or trial judge knows that you can't simply pick up a deposition transcript and read it and figure out how to cross-examine a witness. You have, in order to do your job, have to be present at that deposition so that you know what makes that witness tick. We've all been through that.
Now, in one of these cases, if my memory is correct, and it might not be, client said, we're going to get another lawyer. Was that one of these cases? Because we have another case, Jensen, coming up.
Yeah, the first case. First of all, in the first case, the client filed an affidavit in the Court of Appeals. It's in the record, saying that I have full confidence in Mr. Ball and that I desire him to remain as my counsel. But then, given the fact that there was a lengthy appeal involved here, and Mr. Ball, being the professional person that he is, consented to the change of counsel, so that in this court basically agreed because it granted an appropriate motion so that that case could proceed.
Is that moot then?
Is what moot?
That whole issue in that case.
Mr. Ball's discharge? No, it's not moot at all. If he was wrongfully kicked out of a case, there could be an argument that he would be entitled to share in the fees for all of the work he did. And on the other hand, if this court says, yes, you were definitely a bad boy here, then there'd be an argument that he'd lose the benefit of all this work. So that, Your Honor, I cannot emphasize too strongly that this case is not moving.
And maybe damages for causing extra costs or delay or whatever.
That I don't understand.
Well, he might be liable for damages if he, to the client, if the client suffered any damages because...
That would be a possibility, yes, Your Honor. Now...
Mr. Hildebrand, just to continue on with the Chief's line of questioning, assuming this was an in-state lawyer, could the judge bar him from his courtroom?
I don't see how. There's no rule that lets trial judges do that.
So the trial judge then his only recourse would be to refer that lawyer to the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
That is correct. And under our rules, both judges and lawyers have that responsibility.
And if
Mr. Ball's conduct was so bad in this, the OLR and its predecessor, Bapper, clearly had jurisdiction to review and discipline out-of-state lawyers, and that's been done in other states, as we cited in our brief. Nobody ever referred Mr. Ball to OLR. In fact, the trial judge in neither case found that there was any violation of the rules of professional conduct, and there was absolutely no citation of any so-called rules of decorum that were violated.
Counsel, let's take a look at the rule that is the focus of this case. One of the problems I have with your argument is... And I'll start with the argument that you advance in the brief concerning the standards. That is, a standard of egregious conduct or have the potential to infect future proceedings. I see, as I read this rule, 10.03 sub 4, standards set. The standards include that there may be withdrawal under sub 4 if the conduct manifests incompetency to represent a client in a Wisconsin court or by his or her unwillingness to abide by the rules of professional conduct for attorneys and the rules of decorum of the court. I see no place the standard that you advance of egregious conduct or conduct that has the potential to infect future proceedings?
I think the standard under the rule is substantially the same as the standards in the out-state and federal cases that I cited, and I'll tell you why.
I have before me the rules of several other states. Those rules don't comport with the language that we have in our code as I see them and review them.
They don't have the language that's in SCR 10.03 sub 4, but these other state cases do rely either one way or another on the rules of professional conduct, which are basically incorporated into SCR 10.04. And then, since this is, I think everyone agrees that this is a matter of discretion, then these other courts look and to see whether or not the discretion was properly exercised. Now, if I may return to the rule,
I want to stay on the rule. Is there anything in the legislative history of the rule that you can advance for the proposition that the standard should be egregious or have the potential to infect future proceedings?
Not in the legislative history of the rule, but in the terms of the rule itself. First of all, the rule says that there has to be either incompetence, which nobody has argued that there was incompetence, or a refusal or failure to follow the rules of professional conduct or rules of decorum. If you look at the decision of
isn't there an argument here? Not an argument. I mean, as I read Judge Atkinson's ruling, he references competence. And arguably, Judge McKay's ruling references competence as defined in the rules.
There is no reference in Judge McKay's ruling to Attorney Ball's incompetence.
Well,
there is nothing.
How do you define incompetence?
Well, I think incompetence means that you have a lawyer that is incompetent to prosecute a medical malpractice case, and Mr. Ball is a very experienced plaintiff's medical malpractice lawyer. There was no incompetence here. He took many, many depositions and prepared for trial and was ready to go for trial. What happened here was that the judge didn't like the fact that he was pushing too hard to get evidence in, and this is something that trial courts do every day.
Isn't incompetence defined under the rules as lack of familiarity, skill, or knowledge?
Yes.
And didn't Judge McKay find that your apparent unfamiliarity or disregard for the procedural rules of this jurisdiction and your continued failure to heed the admonitions for this court regarding your conduct result?
Well, that's what he said, but if you would please look at the record, there was this business of the opening statement, there was this business of whether or not the disclosure of treating physicians as experts was appropriate. There was a question of whether or not he pushed too hard in his questions and exceeded the rulings of the court. But you can review this record, I think, and see that the kinds of things that happened here, the opening statement, I frankly don't understand. The questions of Dr. Inglis, some of these questions weren't even objected to, and so the question is that we have a characterization. I wouldn't call it a finding because there are no findings. All the judge did was say that he didn't like the way Ball had conducted this trial, and that's not a sufficient basis under SCR 10.04. Or 10.03 to revoke a lawyer.
If we stay with McKay, then you don't find that the phrase your apparent unfamiliarity or disregard for the procedural rules of this jurisdiction, and I would excerpt the middle part, in other words, your apparent unfamiliarity with the procedural rules of this jurisdiction falls within the definition of competence, of lack of knowledge or skill.
Judge, there were no procedural rules that were violated.
There were orders of the court that were violated. repeatedly.
There was a misunderstanding about what the scope of the questions and answers of this witness could be.
Oh, but that's a judgment call for the trial judge to make in the exercise of his sound discretion, is it not? We don't second-guess that.
All right, well, here's the problem with discretion, and let me return, please, to the rule itself. In the exercise of their discretion, neither one of these trial judges found that there was any violation of any of the rules of professional conduct.
Well,
neither one of these judges found that there was a violation of any rule of decorum. They didn't even mention this, and neither judge said that Mr. Ball was incompetent.
Isn't the violation of a court order professional misconduct under our rules, even if they didn't cite one of the rules?
Well, that's the question. Was there a violation of a court order?
That's what the court said. Because Ball's conduct evinced an unwillingness to comply with the court's orders. Isn't that what was said, or what the trial judge's conclusion was?
Well, but that's why we're here, Your Honor. You have the transcript, and you can see what happened. And sure, I've sat through trials where lawyers, and I and my opponent have asked the questions, been objected to, objection sustained. We asked the question in a slightly different way. Objection overruled, and you go on. And to say that a lawyer runs the risk of disbarment for violating a court order because he pushes to get that evidence in, that's what happened here. And I don't think, had this case been referred to BAPR or OLR, I don't think they would have had...
Is it permissible under our rules to push to get evidence in when it has been specifically precluded by a court order? How can that be?
But you see, your assumption is that it was specifically precluded.
The scope of this doctor's testimony was the subject of many discussions among counsel and the court on the record, and there was a specific preclusion of certain areas of testimony, and it is therefore impermissible for a trial lawyer to push the edges of that envelope.
Yes, but I don't think that the court order was that clear as to exactly what could be done and what couldn't.
Wasn't there a violation of some pretrial orders as well? I mean, I think this is a series of violations that the trial judge was focusing on.
The trial judge talked about some misstatement made in opening statement, which I think he talked about that when he revoked him. That was corrected. He talked about a problem that Mr. Ball had about telling opposing counsel. They brought that to the attention of the court, and that was solved. This happens every day in our courts.
That lawyers violate orders.
No, as cases go along, there are sometimes disputes and disagreements about disclosures and discovery, and you either work them out or you bring it to the court, and if the court resolves it, then you go on. And that's what happened here. You don't revoke a lawyer's license or an in-state lawyer. You don't turn them over to OLR for stuff like that. It just doesn't happen.
Well, Mr. Hildebrand, as I understand this record, the judge told Mr. Ball, by court order, that he could not make any inquiry of Dr. Inglis with respect to legal cause.
That's true.
And I'm somewhat confused between the difference between legal cause and medical cause, because it seemed to me that what Mr. Ball was asking was, at least arguably, could have been, what is the condition that he suffered from, not what caused it. Is that what his, is that your argument?
Well, basically that's true. When a witness is told not to discuss legal cause, mm-hmm. but he can discuss a medical cause, and someone then steps over the line as to what the trial judge meant by his order.
But what's the difference between medical cause and legal cause?
I do not know. And I don't think anybody else knows either. And that's what makes the result of this case so unjust.
Mr. Hildebrand, do you take issue on behalf of your client with the granting of the mistrial in the first instance here?
Well, my client does not believe that mistrial was appropriately granted, but in effect, that's water over the dam, and we're not here arguing about the mistrial because it's moot.
But isn't that tied directly to the issue that you were just discussing with Justice Babbage?
Well, it depends on why there was a mistrial. If there was a mistrial because of misconduct of counsel, and it turns out that there was no misconduct of counsel, then you have a situation where you still have to have a new trial, but counsel should not be sanctioned or revoked. And we contend that that based on what happened, that Mr. Ball should not be sanctioned or revoked. In the Burnett versus Ault case, counsel was fined for instructing an expert witness or a treating physician, I believe, not to answer expert witness testimony. And the case came all the way up here, and the court said, well, the counsel was right. So the sanction was removed.
You dispute the trial judge's conclusion that that your client acted inappropriately, right? What's the standard of review? The trial judge says you disobeyed my order.
All right. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. First of all, in the Loy case, which my opponent cited, lays out how you review abuse of discretion. First of all, you have to examine the relevant facts. And if you look on appendix page 195, that's the guts of Judge McKay's decision. He didn't represent, he didn't review the relevant facts. Then it says, apply them to a proper standard of law. He didn't cite the rule, and he didn't cite any of the standards in the rule. And using a demonstrated rational process, which was not done, he was very angry, reach a conclusion. Now, what this court does is to see whether or not the judge exercised proper discretion. And I don't think that was done here, because the governing statute or rule here was not even referred to. And Judge Atkinson did the same thing. Essentially, what he did was look at what happened before Judge McKay and said, you're out of here. You're disbarred. That's not the exercise of discretion. And when an appellate court looks at the exercise of discretion, this is the standard. And quite bluntly, this was not a proper exercise of discretion. If discretion was properly exercised using the proper factors, which was not done here, then this court should give the deference to the trial judge. But if discretion was not exercised properly, then there's a misuse of discretion, and the trial judge's opinion cannot stand.
Counsel, I note that, again, focusing on the words of the rule 10.034, that at appendix 195, Judge McKay did not reference that rule. That rule indicates, in arguably relevant part, that a standard is his or her willingness to abide by the rules of professional conduct for attorneys and the rules of decorum of the court. I found it interesting that, although not referenced by Judge McKay, it seemed to me he must have had the rule before him, because the word the Supreme Court 10.034 says unwillingness to abide by the rules of professional conduct for attorneys. Judge McKay says unwillingness to abide by the rules of this court. Now, it could be that Judge McKay just out of the blue chose the words on that November day in 1998. Your willingness to abide by the rules, but it's a little uncanny that it seems verbatim.
Well, let me answer the question this way. Please do not make the same mistake that the Court of Appeals did. We are resting our case on the discretion and the law of discretion and on the law of SCR 10.04. In upholding discretion of the trial judge, you have to see whether or not that discretion was properly exercised under the standards in Loy versus Bunderson and other cases. What the Court of Appeals did, it wasn't satisfied with this record. So what the Court of Appeals did is it searched the record to try to do exactly what your question suggests and says, oh, there must have been a violation of Rule 3.4. Oh, he must have been incompetent. Or, he didn't do this and he didn't do that, but that's
my
not...
My question, counsel, is meant to suggest that the very words that Judge McKay employed are the, for some reason, unwillingness to abide by the rules, the exact words found in 10.034. That's what my question is.
Yeah, but what rules did he violate? He didn't violate Rule 3.4. He didn't violate any rules of professional conduct. He didn't violate any rules of decorum, or there would have been he needed to show no unwillingness to do that. So the abuse of discretion was here because the judge did this by fiat and not through the considered exercise of discretion that a judge is supposed to do when he imposes serious and imposing sanctions upon a lawyer and his counsel, her counsel.
Chief?
Yes.
If you prevail, Mr. Hildebrand, I understand in the first case there's already different counsel, so
yes,
you might make adjustments on fees and all sorts of things. What about the second case?
I don't know the status of the second case, but in the second case, nothing much was done at the time of revocation. There was maybe one or two depositions, and then defense counsel came in and said, well, you were revoked in this one. We're going to have you revoked in the other case, and then Mr. Ball stopped the deposition, and they went in before Atkinson, and Atkinson decided to revoke. And I really don't know what the progress of or lack of progress in that case has been, but that brings up a real concern about the collegiality issues and the sanctions issues, because this court has held it numerous times that sanctions should not be imposed unless they're absolutely necessary, and that sanctions should be tailored to fit the abuse or the violation. None of that was done here, and it would be our contention that the case law that this court has so wisely adopted be applied here to the sanction of removing a pro hoc vice counsel. And I think there was a lot of wisdom in Justice Bradley's dissenting opinion in Burnett versus Ault, where she talked about collegiality. These people, the defense counsel, ran in and essentially got Mr. Ball revoked and OBI, and there was absolutely nothing he did wrong in that case.
As a practical matter, could Mr. Ball handle the trial in the OBI case?
There was no trial. They were in the pretrial discovery stages.
But I'm saying, if you prevail, as a practical matter, could he go back before Judge Atkinson and handle this trial, given the tension?
Well, as you know, Your Honor, parties have the right to substitute on a reversal, so maybe there would be a substitution, but regardless of that, Mr. Ball's disbarment, in effect, would be lifted, and he could appear in that case and try it before whoever judge.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. McCracken, you have 15 minutes representing Attorney Halloyne. Okay, you can do that. Mr. Gutfass, you represent Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund.
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Thank you. It's been 10 years since I've argued, and I have two cases on the same day. I want to thank you for giving us the privilege to talk with you today as well. And appreciating that you've read the briefs and questions somewhat extensively, I'm going to shorten up to some degree what I had to say. I'm the only participant at this stage of the proceedings that was actually a witness to what had happened during the trial. And I can tell you as an advocate that I think our position has to be, after having viewed this, that Judge McKay exercised appropriate discretion in doing what he did. It was a well-thought-out decision on what had occurred. He determined that Mr. Ball's conduct warranted revocation of his privilege, not his license, to temporarily appear in Wisconsin on this case. And we believe that the choice of counsel doesn't override the judge's important desire to keep order in the courtroom, to let the litigants have a fair trial, well, counsel, and avoid mistrial.
Counsel, your opposing counsel, Mr. Hildebrand, raises the point that this action essentially makes Pro Hoc Vitae counsel second-class lawyer, because the judge would not have had the discretion to remove an in-state attorney. Do you agree with that?
I don't think it makes him or her a second status or second-tier counsel. They are not licensed to practice in Wisconsin. They don't have the right to practice in Wisconsin when they come in on an isolated case.
But if the problem that I see is that obviously trial lawyers push the envelope on, you know, both plaintiffs and defense. I've been on both sides. And you push it. And when you don't like the judge's ruling, you know, you push here and you push there and you look for where. In fact, an old experienced trial hand once told me that your real opponent is the judge up there, not the fellow sitting or woman sitting over on the other bench. So you push the envelope, and a Wisconsin attorney, it seems to me, can push the envelope harder and with more vigor, knowing full well that pushing the envelope is not going to get him kicked out of the courtroom and kicked out of the case, whereas an out-of-state counsel, admitted, cannot represent his client with as much vigor or as much pushing of the envelope for fear that what will happen is exactly what happened here.
Well,
if you could respond to that.
I would say that they're on equal footing from the standpoint that if you transgress, you can be significantly punished, whether you're from out-of-state or in-state. The mechanism of punishment may be different, but I don't think that the deterrence is the deterrence factor is unequal at all. In our case, Your Honor, this isn't a case of pushing the envelope too far in the zealous advocacy for the client. This is a case where repeatedly in pretrial and intratrial activities, counsel decided to disregard what the judge had clearly delineated many times was the restriction with respect to a particular area of evidence, that being the treating physician's testimony. And what I think is appalling and supports the judge's decision to revoke the Pro Hoc Vitae is that there was no, in my opinion, the record supports that there was no mistake with respect to what the judge's order repeatedly given and reflected by counsel as having been understood repeatedly in the record as to what it meant. He could not testify. The treating physician could not testify as to what caused the injury, whether there was negligence in the case, or what damages had been suffered.
But counsel, the problem that I have is that if this was an in-state counsel, the judge had available to him summary contempt proceedings, would have referred him afterwards to Office of Lawyer Regulation, could have, well, I don't want to say this because I see it happening, but in some cases, we have seen where judges have greatly limited the ability of the lawyer to make objections, those, but not remove him from the case. And here, he's removed from the case halfway through the trial.
I think that, well, okay, I think that the judge made a decision based on what the Supreme Court rule is with respect to status of pro hoc vici attorneys, that given the attitude that had been displayed, the contempt for his rulings, and he was in a position to see the personality, the tone of voice, the demeanor, the long history of dealings with this court, that he wasn't going to take it anymore. And I think he had the right under that Supreme Court rule to articulate his reasons and do what engage in the relief that he was authorized to engage in, which was to remove him from this case.
Well, and isn't there a difference in status between an attorney admitted pro hoc vici and an attorney who's licensed to practice in this state? They're subject to the same code of conduct,
right,
pursuant to 28.5, but their status before the court is different. One is appearing in the status of privilege, and the other of license.
Right.
And so doesn't that make a difference here?
I don't think it makes a difference to me in arguing the propriety of what Judge McKay did. One could argue that maybe there should be a way to keep them on more equal footing, but with respect to the type of punishment that can be applied, but I don't think it affects the propriety of what Judge McKay did, which I think is an important reason why we're here today.
Well, in both instances, there's a mistrial, whether it's a lawyer in-state or pro hoc vici, right?
Correct.
Okay. So in both cases, the client has suffered. Now the question is, does the client have the right to bring in an out-of-state lawyer for the second trial? Same case, second trial. Can the client's desire, choice of counsel, outweigh the court system, which is set forth by us, the court system's doctrine that there's a choice of going through the OLR or getting rid of them under 10.034? Isn't that the issue? I mean, I would have argued here that you got a new case. Once you got a mistrial, you got a new case. It's got the same party number, but maybe it's got a new case number in the trial court. I don't know. But it's a new ball game. New ball game. That the trial judge now has discretion to let him in. Whether you call it take him out or letting him in, you wind up with the same thing. And we gave him that discretion.
Are you talking about he has the discretion to allow the clients to have another different out-of-state attorney or the same?
Well, his discretion is the clients come back in on the second trial and say, we want the same lawyer. Now the trial judge says, well, new ball game, I'm not letting him in as pro hoc vici because I have discretion to let him in, and I think that he's destructive of our system. What's the matter with that argument?
I don't think there's anything wrong with it because I think that's what Judge McKay intended in his ruling in this case.
As soon as you got a mistrial, you got a problem. And you would have had a mistrial with counsel, in-state counsel or out-of-state counsel. I mean, one would assume
Correct.
That. If you
Correct.
Don't, you really got a problem.
Right. If either type of attorney
Right.
had committed that conduct, there would have been a mistrial.
Could a Wisconsin, could Judge McKay, following up with the Chief's question, could Judge McKay have forbidden the same attorney from representing her if this attorney was an in-state lawyer?
Motion for disqualification, maybe?
Perhaps. I hadn't really given thought to that.
Counsel, I'm confused about something, and it goes back a little bit in terms of this particular case. It's my understanding that when there was a disclosure of expert witnesses, that Mr. Ball disclosed all treating physicians. Dr. Inglis was a treating physician. Why was he not being considered as an expert?
The history behind that aspect of things is that we have, when you practice a lot of medical malpractice defense and plaintiff cases like we do, one of the issues is a general generic disclosure, a sufficient disclosure to alert the other side that there's somebody waiting in the wing somewhere that could be an important witness. And I don't have the case site exactly, but I think that it's been held that you do have to specifically disclose the names of physicians to comport with the scheduling order. And in this case, we attempted to take Dr. Inglis's deposition twice. It was canceled by a...
Well, you clearly knew that he was a treating physician, didn't you? That wasn't a surprise.
That wasn't the issue. But what we were concerned about was we were told, it was communicated that he was not going to be an expert witness at the trial by Mr. Ball. His deposition was canceled twice. We didn't think he was going to be testifying in an area that was of concern to us. And then a few days before trial, Mr. Ball wanted to take this doctor's deposition and, in our opinion, turn him into an expert witness, and Judge McKay wouldn't let him. So there was an order preventing this witness from giving the deposition, and he was allowed to appear at trial, but there were restrictions that were clear and substantial placed on the nature of his testimony that were repeatedly attempted to be circumvented, which is the real issue with respect to the conduct that's here today. So speaking to something that one of the justices asked earlier of Mr. Hildebrand, I think a competent attorney would have made an offer of proof with Dr. Inglis, preserved the record, and not continued to challenge in front of the jury the authority of the court so that the entire mess was created and a mistrial was unavoidable. I think that was one of the things that Judge McKay was inferring when he made his decision with respect to unfamiliarity with how to proceed. You can't always get in front of the jury what you want, but that doesn't mean that you have to oppose the judge at every turn and make a mess of the orderly proceedings that we're trying to do in putting the trial in. So from that standpoint, I see my light is on. And
you have until the red light goes on.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Counsel, if I may, again, I want to focus on 10.034 and follow up on an argument made by your opposing counsel. And I want to also reference Judge McKay's ruling. Judge McKay, in part, says, your apparent unfamiliarity or disregard for the procedural rules of this jurisdiction and your continued failure to heed admonitions. He also says your unwillingness to abide by the rules of this court. Now, your opposing counsel advances the argument that when you look at 10.034, it says unwillingness to abide by the rules of professional conduct for attorneys. Is it your position that Judge McKay was relying on that phrase, question number one? And if so, question number two, show me in the record where he made any determination of willingness to abide by the rules of professional conduct for attorneys.
Well, I think that the judge had this section in mind when he issued what I think was a well thought out decision about what happened and his reasons for it. I think that the judge was looking at the record where repeatedly the orders of the court were disregarded by Mr. Ball, attempted to be circumvented, and it was a direct circumvention continually.
Is that conduct a violation of the rules of professional conduct for attorneys or the rules of decorum of the court?
I would think it would be.
What rules? What rule or rules are you referencing them?
Well, under the rules of professional responsibility, you can't knowingly, intentionally disregard an order of the court. I don't recall the number of the rule, but it's in there. And this was repeatedly done by Mr. Ball.
It's in there. Is that the rule that the Court of Appeals relied on, that you're relying on? Because there's some argument that that rule isn't appropriate.
Well, the appellate court relied on Supreme Court Rule 23.4 sub C.
It's entitled Fairness to Opposing Party and Counsel. C says knowingly disobey an obligation under the rules of the tribunal, except for an open refusal based on an assertion that no valid obligation exists.
Correct.
Does that apply here?
I think it does.
Explain to me why or how.
Well, the ruling of the court, which I assume is a synonym for the tribunal, was that he could not go into this important area or these important areas with the witness. And he knowingly disobeyed the obligation that he had to follow the judge's ruling, did not make an offer of proof, instead continued to try to get in impermissible evidence in front of the jury, disregarding the tribunal or court's decision on that issue. And that unwillingness to obey Judge McKay's rules, the appellate court and I think this court should find, was an appropriate basis to withdraw the non-resident attorney's pro hoc vici status.
Thank you, counsel. Any other questions? All right. Mr. McCracken, representing...
I have Dr. Halloway.
Pardon me?
I represent Dr. Halloway. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Robert McCracken from Manitowoc. My firm represents Dr. Halloway in both the MacArthur case and the Olby case. My role here today is to discuss Judge Atkinson's decision in the Olby case. I join in Mr. Gutglass's remarks with respect to the MacArthur case.
If I may, since you join in those comments, I refrain from asking a final question because this time ran out. But I was referring, when questioning finished, to 20.3.4 sub C. That's what the Court of Appeals relied on in the involving Judge McKay. And if you are able or prepared to answer this question, hopefully you are, but if not, that's fine because it involves the other case. The heading of that Supreme Court rule is fairness to opposing party and counsel. In response to my question, sub C was interpreted as meaning normally disobeying a ruling of the court, and yet the heading is fairness to opposing party and counsel.
Well, perhaps... that is indeed the function of a trial judge, is to assure justice in our courts by being a referee. And in that sense, making sure everyone plays by the same rules and we have a fair outcome. And I think you could perhaps explain that rule in that fashion. I agree with Mr. Gutglass's remarks that the apparently either ignorant or willful disobedience of a court order that said, tell your opponents what day you're going to bring your trial witnesses in, and then you get a lawyer back saying, I'm not going to do it. And then having conferences in chambers with the court, where the court repeatedly says, you're not going to ask cause questions, you're not going to ask liability questions, and then you go right out in the courtroom, and you ask Dr. Inglis not, doctor, what was your diagnosis? No objection, that would have been permissible. But instead, you come in the back door, doctor, were you able to rule out X as a cause? Were you able to rule out B as a cause? That was a clever attempt to circumvent the court's order, and I would argue, with the skill of the lawyer involved, that it was perhaps intentional.
Counsel, before we get to those questions, I want to talk to you about this opening statement, because the Court of Appeals referred to that also. What is, just a couple of preliminary questions, what is hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy damage?
I think, Your Honor, that would refer to a deprivation of oxygen to the brain, which results in permanent brain damage.
Okay, is that a condition or a cause?
That would, in this case, I believe that would be the cause of the youngster's brain damage.
So it's not a condition that this person suffered from?
Not in the strict sense of the word. That is the injury, I believe. Deprivation of oxygen, which resulted in permanent brain damage. The tissue was dead.
Well, what caused that?
That, indeed, was the subject of the trial.
And what caused it? Wasn't the cause here, at least the allegation, that there was some kind of manipulation of the child, because the child was in a breech position, and it was the manipulation that caused the condition?
I don't feel comfortable answering that at this time, Your Honor. I would be glad to refer to Mr. Gutglass, who was present at the time that testimony was presented.
Well, it's important to me because at least I have a concern here that the trial judge confused condition with cause. Okay? I mean, it's one thing to say that the baby suffered from this encephalopathy, words that I cannot pronounce. It's another thing to say that this was caused by a manipulation of the child. And Judge McKay certainly was telling Dr. Inglis, you can't testify as to cause. But I seriously question as to whether or not he was testifying as to cause.
Well, all I can say is the trial court felt he was, Your Honor, by the presentation of the questions.
I mean, it seems to me it's like saying, well, I've got rheumatism, or I've got cancer. Well, what caused it? Cigarettes. But when I say that I've got cancer, that's not the same thing as saying that I caused it. That's causal. That's causal to my death, I guess, but the cause of the condition is something else.
Well, I think the series of questions were indeed ones, were you able to rule out this as the cause? Were you able to rule out that as the cause? Those alternative cause factors would have been perhaps liability defenses that the trial court did not want that particular witness to get into because he had not been identified to the opposition as an expert for purposes of liability and causation.
Mr. McCracken, you wanted to talk a little bit, as I understood your opening statement, in regard to the OB case, is that right?
Yes, that's what I prepared for.
Well, let me, if I might, ask you some questions in that regard.
Sure.
My understanding was that when Judge Atkinson made his ruling granting the motion to revoke the pro hoc vice status of Mr. Ball, that he had a partial transcript before him of what had occurred in regard to Judge McKay. What was in that transcript? In other words, when we're talking about a partial transcript, exactly what was presented to Judge Atkinson?
I believe that was the transcript of the hearing before Judge McKay, where motions were taken up subsequent to the mistrial.
All right, so in other words, it wasn't the testimony that we see in the briefs having to do with Dr. Inglis and what he was being asked and how he was answering. It was rather the after the mistrial transcript.
I think, Justice Crook, there is some mention of the questions in Judge McKay's remarks in those motions, but I am not aware whether or not Judge Atkinson went all the way back and looked at the specific daily copy of Dr. Inglis.
Now, it's my understanding that when Judge Atkinson acted, it was before there had been any real proceedings in front of him other than perhaps a scheduling conference.
Right.
Is that correct?
Correct. Right. And I think he was right to do what he did. I do not think he abused his discretion. And I would like to say that my basis for that is as follows. He based his decision on facts, the facts of a mistrial in another court in a similar case, malpractice, and on Judge McKay's making a finding that Mr. Ball was unable to abide court rules. He applied the proper standard of law, 10.3.4. He used a rational process. He weighed the misconduct of Ball against the right to select counsel of the appellants. And then he reached the rational conclusion, which was when you do that weighing, I'm going to come out in favor of maintaining the integrity of the court system, and I'm going to disqualify Attorney Ball from the Atkinson case. I'm going to wade right into the hornet's nest here because my time is going to run out, but I do want to take on what has troubled the court today a little bit. I think, Justice Babbitt, you asked whether courts can disqualify resident attorneys. The answer to that, in my judgment, is yes. That's an inherent power. I've seen it exercised, and I'll give you an illustration. Auto accident case, an attorney defended the traffic citation given to the driver, and then the attorney turned around and tried to take the personal injury case of the passenger against the driver. The trial court in that case disqualified him because he possessed confidential information by defending the traffic ticket that could have been used in the personal injury case, and the judge, on a motion by the defense, eliminated that counsel from that case. So I think it can be done. I think it's an inherent power. I can't cite you a statute. On this whole issue, we ought to defer to the Office of Lawyer Regulation and not allow the discretionary power to withdraw pro hoc vice. I disagree with that completely. First of all, I don't regard withdrawal of pro hoc vice as the equivalent of disbarment. All pro hoc vice withdrawal does is take a lawyer out of one case. Disbarment takes a lawyer out of all cases. There's a distinction there. The other thing is under 10.3.4, the withdrawal is not mandatory. It's discretionary. Court does not have to do it. Is there a good reason to give a court that kind of discretion? I say yes, and for this reason. A resident lawyer has passed the Wisconsin Bar Examination or is a graduate of our two law schools. That is per se competency, evidence of competency. The out-of-state pro hoc vice lawyer has not passed the Wisconsin Bar Examination, and he has not probably gone to a Wisconsin law school. The ability of the trial court to withdraw pro hoc vice amounts to one strike and you're out. But I think there's a good reason for one strike and you're out, and it's to protect the citizens of the state of Wisconsin from incompetent counsel who haven't previously established their competency by passing the bar exam or going to our law schools. Finally, there's a very practical concern. Why should we let trial judges pull the ticket in a single case? I think Judge Atkinson here, he felt he needed to maintain decorum and justice in his court. If he had to wait for the investigatory process of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, the OB case could be over with before a decision would be entered. There's been one of the appellant's arguments is that Judge McKay did not specify which rules of professional responsibility and which rules of decorum were violated, and therefore Judge Atkinson had no legal basis for withdrawal. I don't think that's the case. Ball's conduct was the basis for the withdrawal, not the quality of the citations of Judge McKay. There's an argument in the briefs the Supreme Court should develop more specific standards for withdrawal of pro hoc vice status, such as allowing it only for serious misconduct. I don't think you should do that. I don't think there's been any showing that our state is plagued by trial courts improperly withdrawing pro hoc vice status. 10.3.4 is easy to understand. Be competent, be respectful of the court, follow the rules.
Could I ask a question about
sure.
the counsel? How does our rule compare with comparable rules in other states? We always have to be concerned when this court promulgates rules about both the substance and the procedure, whether they're adequate.
The cases that are in the briefs that I read seem to focus more on ethical violations as justification for withdrawal of pro hoc vice status, and there's not too much concern over competency. One court, and I think this is terribly wrong to do, but they said, well, the client will be punished by the incompetence of their counsel, and that's no harm. I think that's the wrong focus. I think all citizens, all participants should be protected from incompetent counsel. But in essence, that's the distinction. We focus not only on what would be considered unethical conduct, and we add in the rules of decorum, but we also talk about competency in Wisconsin.
But is it your view, and then I'll probably ask Mr. Hildebrand the same question, is our rule as drafted with whatever procedures are implicit in it perfectly satisfactory, or is there something deficient about it?
I don't think there's anything deficient about it. I think it's a fine rule. It seems to be also that this subject may be the matter of common law decisions as opposed to codified rules in other states. Justice Prosser, right? I'm not sure every state has done what this court has done by codifying the standards for withdrawal as well as granting.
Mr. McCracken, why shouldn't we adopt the standard that was urged on us by Mr. Hildebrand and talk about egregious conduct as what's really encompassed by our rule, by 10.03 paren 4?
I think the question gives the answer. How are you going to define what's egregious conduct, Justice Crooks? Is it which are the rules of professional responsibility? Which are the rules of decorum stand above the others? Can we accumulate several minor violations, and in the aggregate, they amount to a serious violation? I think to define is to limit. I think the essence of these rules is to give the broadest discretion to the trial courts, subject to an appellate discretionary review.
Counsel, let me tell you what I see as a practical problem when we write this opinion. And that is, we have seen here, and I'm sure it's true at the trial court, out-of-state counsel representing both the plaintiff and the defendant, obviously in different cases, but and if you read the media and the legal media, one, and from my personal experience as a lawyer, one tactic that a lawyer may use is to try and get rid of counsel on the other side. It's costly for the other side. There's delay for the other side. And all of those things can add up to winning by default, in effect, or at least making your the other party win at great cost, which they may or may not want to or be able to incur. So how do we write an opinion that protects against tactics, which I'm not suggesting is in either of these cases, so don't misunderstand my question, tactics used by either plaintiff or defendant to get rid of either an in-state or out-of-state lawyer?
I think trial courts themselves serve as a barrier to the success of that ploy. That merely because the issue is raised, defense counsel, as an illustration, makes a motion to disqualify pro hoc vice counsel, that doesn't automatically mean, of course, that the trial court is going to grant that. And I think that the trial courts in our state are fine individuals, and they will serve as a barrier to that tactic.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Hearing no further questions, we have 5 minutes of rebuttal by Attorney Hildebrand.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. McCracken said that there was inherent power of the court to disqualify counsel. Well, in Wisconsin, that power has only been exercised in cases involving conflict of interest, where a lawyer will take an adverse position against an existing or former client, for example, and that's the sort of a situation. There is absolutely no authority that a trial court can disqualify a lawyer because the trial court believes the lawyer is incompetent or whatnot. That would be an astounding proposition if this court would embrace it. This then gets over to the licensing issue, which is dealt with by an agency of this court.
Is there something in the rules that says that that cannot be done, or is it just the fact that it hasn't yet been done?
There's no specific rule that allows trial courts to disqualify counsel, and case law has allowed it in disqualification for conflicts because it interferes with the integrity of the proceedings before the court.
Well,
but trial courts don't have the authority to disbar lawyers.
Trial courts have the authority, the inherent authority, over what goes on in their courtrooms, and if a lawyer is repeatedly violating court orders, wouldn't it, by analogy, be authorized to grant a disqualification motion for Rambo litigation tactics if that's
no,
what
no,
the situation
the lawyer,
presented?
No, the lawyer can be sanctioned. There are plenty of rules allowing sanctions, and this court has developed a well body of case law on sanctions, and that's because those are set up under the rules of procedure and some statutes which provide for sanctions. But this court has retained the right to disbar lawyers, and this court has established a regulatory system to deal with
that. Well, I understand that, but a disqualification is not a disbarment. It's a one-case-only order. And is there any authority that says that a trial judge may not disqualify a lawyer on a case because of misconduct other than conflict of interest?
Not that I know of.
Okay, so there's nothing that prohibits that. It just hasn't been done.
It hasn't been done, but I would suggest to Your Honor that the body of law on sanctions and the fact that this court has the exclusive power to regulate the practice of law says the trial courts don't have this power.
What about the Lehman case? Now, I know that that wasn't dealing with a revocation of Pro Hoc Vici, and there seems to be a dearth, quite frankly, counsel point out in this state regarding the law, but that's one case that did address what the purpose of, did interpret the provision before us. And that case stated the purpose of SCR 10034 is, number one, to control the unauthorized practice of law, number two, to assure the public is not put upon or damaged by inadequate, or number three, unethical representation. So, do you take...
I don't take issue with that.
Okay.
And I would like to address Justice Prosser's question, is our rule adequate? And I think that it is, but I think that the rule sets up standards that have to be followed. And when you look at that rule and then you consider the body of case law on sanctions as to how they're imposed and why they're imposed and that they have to be tailored as to what the offense is and all of that, and when you couple that with the undisputed case law or statements here before the court that this is a matter of discretion, we've got a Loy and numerous other cases that measure the exercise of discretion and how it's done and how appellate courts have to do that. We do not need any new rules here. But what we need is to have standards that this court, I would respectfully submit, should write an opinion that tells trial courts how they are to exercise their discretion, because we're ships at sea here without any guidance. And Justice Crooks talked about this standard of egregiousness. The reason why that standard is important is that in the exercise of discretion, which wasn't done here, there has to be a balancing. There has to be a right to counsel. That has to be considered. You have to look at how much work has been done and what the nature of the violation is and all of that and whether or not the punishment fits the crime, so to speak. And that wasn't done here. And in the Obie case, all the judge did was look at the decision of Judge McKay and said, well, I don't want this to happen. It was an effective disbarment. All I'm asking this court to do is to insist the trial judges look at SCR 10.034 and follow that rule and exercise their discretion in a balanced and reasoned manner. That was not done here. I would rest my case on that, and I again thank the court for the privilege of appearing and listening to my argument.
Thank you, Attorney Hildebrand.
The court will take a few moments for the